There's a nice correlation between law and finance. Clearly in law you have a lot of guiding principles, mostly found in case law and precedents, that suggest what the right answer is going to be and how a case is going to be decided, and you've spent a lot of time preparing for those. But you'd readily admit, I think, that even given those, every case is a little bit unique and a little bit different, and whatever happened in the past is absolutely no guarantee of what's going to happen in the future. And finance is no different than that. As I talk, there will be a number of issues that there are clearly some guiding principles and some great logic, and that's what I'll actually hit on, but I'll also characterize it as the same way as it would be in law, that your case, your specific circumstances, anybody else's can be unique, and that'll govern what the real answer is going to be. And then last but not least, looking back is no guarantee in finance of what's going to happen in the future. But I'll also share with you some information that would tell you you really can predict it pretty accurately, much like you can as you examine the law from your side of the point of view. You can be certain most of the time. You just can't be absolutely certain. Next piece I'd like to jump into is just sort of 10 guiding principles that you ought to keep in mind. And they're actually pretty interesting. One is, and probably one of the greatest things that folks should do, and that is sort of the Stephen Covey principle of beginning with the end in mind, and that's set your goals. If you came to me and said, I need some financial advice or would like you to do a financial plan for me, I really can't do one until you tell me where you would like to go, and what money means to you and how much you'd like to have and what's your goal for what you're going to do with it. Because virtually every investment you need and the amounts you need will drive what the plan is going to be. So if you sort of begin with the end mind, set your own standards. For some of you in the room, is that you're going to want to be a multimillionaire. I mean, that's clearly one reason why you have performed so well and you picked a school that's so substantial as the University of Virginia. You'll have a chance to accumulate millions of dollars. For others, they'll say, that doesn't light my fire. What I really want is a little bit more public service and some other avenues. This is a great educational background, but money's not the objective. Your financial plans will look completely different. Others will have a very high income and potentially just needs to accumulate that income, that is, save more than, spend less than you're making, and all by itself it will become a huge amount of money. Just make sure we're on sort of the same page. To me, huge amounts of money generally are in the millions. It used to be not long ago, a millionaire was an exceptional person. It still is. If you've got more than $1 million net worth, you're probably in the top 5% of the population of the U.S. So in a room of 20 people, 19 don't have as much as you do. But that's still a big number in the U.S. And most people who leave law school and can command a salary of $150,000 or more, certainly in a working career, if they plan wisely, should end up with a net worth in the $5 to $10 million range. Make a lot more money than that, and you plan carefully, and it can be a lot larger than that. No tales out of school, but I have worked with UVA law faculty, some of whom worked as a professor for a while and then went on to other things, that amassed $50, $60, $70 million in a working career, which would be, in all candor, would be sort of my specialty of working with folks with very high net worths. Other professors who have had ordinary incomes at $4, $5, or $10 million, and I can tell you in all those cases, that's a lot of money. And that's a lot of money to make yourself financially independent and do almost anything you want to do in your life. And then others, clearly, who have lived life well, and maybe that's it. If you actually did a net worth, they've managed to leave this life with little or none, but they had a great life while it lasted. And that's what I mean about sort of beginning with the end in mind and setting your own objectives. Do you want to die rich, or do you want to die broke? And they're not as silly as the questions might infer. Die broke, to some extent, is using all of your assets to your total ability all through your lifetime and literally not leaving anything behind. But that could mean you're extremely philanthropic and you do great things. You just didn't care to count the beans. That would tell me, as a financial planner, that would identify a specific strategy. Other folks, and I think you already know a number of them, would say, no, what I want to do is be the richest person on the block, and that's my goal, and that's a different strategy. So, enough said, but the first principle is to begin with the end in mind. Once you have those goals, clearly you can establish your plan, and then you've got all sorts of benchmarks to measure it and see if you're on target, whether or not you need to adjust your strategies and so forth. Second principle, and I touched on it already, never spend more than you make. Simple as it seems, most people spend more than money than they make. They just always, and sometimes law school graduates are some of the folks who are tending to do it the most. You see big bonuses coming, you see big cases being settled, you see big income to come, and you begin to think, I'm worth it, I earned it, I'll go ahead and spend it now, and you're always playing catch up. You always have massive debt sitting out there. And I think you can look around any market that you've been in, and you know there's some attorneys out there who fit that mold exactly. If they would follow that basic rule, which is sort of the most important things you learn in kindergarten, is if you're not making it, don't spend it. If you always make more money than you spend and you live a good, long, healthy, productive life, you will have a lot of money at the end, and you will have, whatever your definition of it is, financial independence. Third rule, and maybe a little controversial, but I have to point it out, and that is marry only once. And I would point that out because, you know, the divorce rate is so high in the U.S. that it just doesn't make any sense. Just think how hard you've worked to be here today and to be embarking on life where you're going next. If you marry well, you have a great personal relationship, and I think if you've read all the articles, stress is less and it's a happier life and all that. And together, you can create a large net worth and accumulate financial independence. But if you can't make it work, you almost have to look back and wonder why you worked so hard to get here, because if you go through one or more divorces, I can almost guarantee you, you'll divide your assets multiple times. And you'll pay folks like yourselves, the attorneys, a lot of money in the process of dividing it. It just doesn't make sense when I look around that somebody would work this hard to get where you are and then go through multiple spouses, at multiple relationships where you have to constantly divide your income and divide your assets. So rule number three, marry only once. The fourth one, and actually an important one that you'll have a little problem avoiding today, but you ought to get out of the habit as quickly as you can, and it's a little bit already an answer to a couple of the questions, is never borrow to fund personal everyday expenses. My sort of rule of thumb on that is when you're borrowing, it should only be to create an asset, and usually an enduring asset. Then it makes sense to borrow the money. And particularly it makes sense if that asset is an appreciating, not a depreciating asset, which jumps to a couple of topics we'll talk to later, like buying a house and the like. A lot of folks, and I'm almost guessing a lot of folks in this room are probably there, found themselves have had to buy everything from clothing to gasoline to dinners out to maybe a weekend getaway and put it on their credit card. And can't pay the credit card off at the end of the month, and therefore it carries as more or less a long-term debt. And, of course, the whole country, the U.S., probably most of the first world country, is awash in that type of debt. And it made no sense. If you're going out to dinner tonight, and you're going, I would use a card, no problem using a credit card if it's only for convenience rather than having cash in your wallet, but you're going to pay it off at the end of the month. If you don't pay it off in the month, you ate dinner, you enjoyed dinner, it was a great dinner, but 15 minutes later it's mostly digested and it's gone. But that bill keeps coming. It just doesn't make any sense. So never borrow to pay daily expenses if you can help it. I think in your case, and I'm going to come back to this as sort of a recurring topic, what you might do at this point, if you feel like I'm talking about you, is having some debt that actually was incurred for sort of miscellaneous expenses that you use something and it's gone and now you still owing on it and paying for it, you can sort of capitalize it in the cost of your education. And that certainly may not apply to everybody, but I know it has to apply to some. Just basically said, you know, I had to borrow money to even pay the rent or whatever else while I'm in law school, and I'll pay it back. That makes sense, and in some ways, mentally, you're capitalizing that in that your education is your capital asset, and now you've got some lingering debt, including tuition debt and so forth, to pay off to make yourself whole. But you're offsetting it with an asset. If it's just a fun night out and it's not related, then you really don't have anything to offset it. So suddenly, if you're picturing your balance sheet, assets on one side, liabilities on the other, you got a liability and absolutely nothing to show for it. That's what I'd point out that fourth principle you want to avoid. Related to that, never take a loan out and let the payments or the loan survive the life of the asset that you bought. Jumping ahead, car loans are often like that. People will try to convince you, particularly as law school graduates, to get a really expensive car, finance it for as long as you can, and put no money down. You won't have that car very long, and you might not actually have it any longer than it takes to drive it off the lot, when suddenly the asset is worth less than you owe on it. And now you have a negative net worth, and you should have never done that. When we get to sort of how to handle your debt, that will be one of the underlying premises we'll go into some additional information on, of always trying to structure debt to match the asset. And usually you're matching the useful life of that asset as opposed to going longer. Never risk a sort of a fifth category, or a sixth category, excuse me. Never risk a lot to gain a little. And mostly I'm talking about transfer of risk. Good examples, when you're out, you might want to cut corners for a while and say, I'll live without health insurance. I'm healthy. I don't think I'll get sick. I won't bother to pay for long-term disability insurance. You're avoiding at that point what might seem pretty expensive to you, but in a relative scheme of things, it's a pretty tiny premium. And what you're risking is the permanent acceptance of risk on your part that you may have an overwhelming medical bill or a long-term disability and no way to get whole again. That would be a good example of risking a lot to gain just a little. Driving a car without insurance. Driving drunk would fit in that category. And attorneys, whatever side of the practice that you expect to be on, you see that as a common mistake. Somebody made a similar stupid decision under this principle to risk a lot to drive home not quite sober, only then to face a criminal charge arrest, a permanent alteration in their career, $1,000 in fines, maybe up to a year in jail, maybe hurt somebody, maybe killed somebody. That's a risk a lot to gain a little, the cheap ride home. So the premise on sort of both living your right life and on finances is sort of step back and assess it. If I'm risking a lot, I want to transfer that risk, I want to mitigate that risk, or I want to avoid that risk. So, for example, health and I may jump on some principles you're already really familiar with, on things like health care and long-term disability, to actually transfer that risk to an insurance company by paying a premium makes a lot of sense. My illustration of a drunk driving, it's a whole lot smarter to not buy extra insurance to try to cover that, but rather avoid that risk, but apply that principle all the way through. Seventh one, never chase the market, and never listen to anybody who tells you they can chase the market. And in fact, I'll do a quick aberration here. What you hear, and maybe this is too early, at least for most of you, as you're beginning to make investments, you'll talk to lots of financial advisors who pretend they can see the other side of the horizon, and I don't care what the career is, they can't. They know where the next hot market sector is. They know the next hot stock. They can pick the next Microsoft coming. They can't. And discipline is what's really going to win out for you. It will lower your fees. It will lower your taxes. It will improve your performance. When we get to investments, I'll talk a little bit more in detail there about a proper asset allocation strategy and where you ought to put your money and in what order, and try to give you a good, solid approach to that. But the early warning is just don't chase the market. Show discipline, set your goals, stay diversified, and you will have a much better performance long-term, net of everything. If you chase the market, you'll find this chart, which I want to show you, and the only important thing is you know that it looks like a rainbow and the colors keep changing, are about the 15 most popular asset allocation categories and which one performed well in each year. And you can name it, whether it's small cap, mid cap, large cap, real estate, cash, bonds. Every single year it jumped around, and if you were chasing the market saying, boy, somebody told me small cap stocks is what I'll put my money in, it may have been the top of the market this year, it'll be the bottom of the market next year. So the discipline was diversification. You'll lose a lot less sleep, you'll spend a lot less money, and you'll have a much better performance. Eighth principle, and I'm coming down off of this, and we'll get more into your specific questions, some real specific advice. Eighth principle is diversify, diversify, diversify. Don't put your eggs all in one basket, and that'll. When I come back to that one, that'll answer a lot of folks' questions again on, you know, what should I do first and where would I put my excess cash, what should I do with my income, what do I do with retirement plans, and so forth. Ninth, an easy one that sort of solidifies everything I've been talking about on that one, is make time and the compound value of interest your ally. If you go back to the very first premise and you make more money than you spend and you take that excess and you apply it to the asset side of things, means you could buy a house, you could buy stocks, you could put it in cash in a savings account. There are a lot of things that you can do with it. As long as you're creating an asset with it, you're not spending it, even though it may feel like you're spending it. You're actually creating something that you own. The compound value, it will be amazing how fast that will grow, and particularly when you think out 20 or 30 or 40 years. When I say make time your ally, your only mistake is to wait to get started. One of the questions was, for example, when should I start putting money into a retirement account? The answer was sort of yesterday. A very small amount of money invested today, 30 years from now, is a huge amount of money. A very large amount of money invested in 30 years is less. It was the fact that you got it invested and that you let the market do its thing and the value of compounding interest, and it's a huge amount of money. And it is awfully tempting to say on a cash flow basis, I really would rather take an extra vacation this year, I'd rather buy a fancier car or whatever else, and delay investing that money, and it will really hurt you in the long run. So the issue is making time your ally. Last but not least on this, before I move on to the next topic, is take time to always give back. You'll find huge rewards from that, both personally and psychologically, and actually looking at the Women of Color organization before I came over and a number of the other groups. Women of Color is the group that invited me to speak, and the other service organizations within the law school. Clearly, if not everybody in this room, it seems like most of the law school is already heavily committed to that principle. But the issue really is you get a good sense of satisfaction. It opens up huge career doors for you. You won't believe the number of times in your career that it will be an acquaintance that you made and an opportunity for service that opened the door for a major opportunity for income producing your career and advancement. That's not the reason for doing it, but the real reason for doing it is, and today's a good example, is if people are willing to help you, including if you just take the value of help that they hire you at different times, it's up to you to sort of make it whole by giving something back. And I'll sort of end on that note. This is a non-commercial presentation by me. I will gladly spend an hour with you. And I hope, and I actually promise you're going to hear throughout the hour some things that should be of some personal advantage for you. What I ask is you don't owe me anything at the end, but if you, in your early career as an attorney, will look for an opportunity to give at least the same amount of time I've given, an hour, back to somebody, giving them legal advice without charging them, we'll be whole. But you'll also see, especially as a cumulative group, everybody doing that, what a difference that will make. So I'll move on. The first step I would encourage everybody to take is to, on your own, you don't have to do it in a class, and everybody would probably find that awkward, is take your own financial measure now, at the end of your law school career, and consider that your sort of starting of your professional point. And that's just filling out a financial statement. One, it's a record you ought to have, and if you haven't done it before, it's actually fairly easy. There are lots of software that helps you through it. Any bank would give you a blank financial statement. Or, geez, more often than not, I just take a piece of notebook paper and do it. On the left-hand side, you're going to list everything you own. And on the right-hand side, you're going to list everything you own, that you owe. Own on the left, assets, liabilities on the right. And I would even suggest, if it were like this, your first asset, there may be some exceptions in the room, but I'm sort of guessing that a lot of you might not own your own car yet, although probably you do. You probably don't own a house, although some of you might. But the one thing you actually have is a law school education. And this may be the only time you'll get a real chance under accounting principles to list it, but it ought to capitalize to you at some value. And it also ought to take the scary part about this side, because on the liability side, I'm guessing that at least one of the reasons a lot of you are in the room is that there must be some debt out there on the law school side. And I actually was looking at some of the averages, and I'll just use an easy one just because my math is simple. If somebody's finishing their undergraduate years in law school and they've got around $100,000 in debt, you're $100,000 in the hole. So what offset it? And you can capitalize this any way you want. I'd just give you easy math. If you believe you're going to leave law school making $100,000 a year, I'd just sort of capitalize it at 10 years' value and say your law school career was worth $1 million. Again, it's pretty darn subjective because some people may not be in law school to make money, and then some of you may be in law school to make a lot of money, so you might capitalize this differently. But rather than show nothing here and a negative $100,000 here, if that's all you had, you'd have a negative $100,000 net worth, and that's a little bit hairy. But the reality is you borrowed this money to create this, and that has value. So let me sort of start with that. If you had an auto, you list that, and it's just, you don't have to waste a lot of time when you're constructing your financial statement to be overly exact, as in, I owe a car loan, and how many pennies is it to, is you feel free to just sort of use your best judgment as to what your balance is and what your fair market value is. You list an auto here and an auto loan on the opposite side and so forth and so on down. When you look at the statements, if you haven't seen them before, clearly there's a little bit more of an order. You usually start at most liquid investments, cash being at the top, and work down to the most illiquid. On the liability side, you start with the short-term stuff, the stuff you must pay in the first year or so, and then your longer-term debt. The value of that, then, when you get to the bottom, is simply your net worth
if you're more accustomed from a prior background with the commercial side, it may be retained, you might call it retained earnings or whatever else. But what you want is a snapshot in time. That's all you're looking for, is what is your net worth today? Then if you'll do this again virtually every year, and I wouldn't waste a lot of time on it, there's nothing you need to update every month or every 3 months or 6 months. Do whatever feels good to you, but you will find it amazingly helpful to do it once a year, at least once a year. And you should see some growth. And the things that I would encourage you to look for in your own financial planning is to see if it all matches up. And again, it'll be some of the things I'll touch on about trying to make sure your assets and your liabilities match. You generally would not want to create any liabilities that didn't create an asset. So if you begin to show a lot of debt over here, a Visa card here, an American Express card here, a lot of unsecured stuff, a line of credit, a couple of overdrafts on your account, and there are no assets to show for them, you know right off the bat you're making a mistake. If you find that you've got a loan balance over here and an asset, the car over here, is the car worth more than the loan? And what you'd like to do is see an expanding balance there. You'd like to be paying off the car loan faster than it's depreciating in value. When you buy a house, or if you already own a real estate property, that traditionally is an appreciating value. Not guaranteed, but it generally is, in which case it goes up all by itself, and what you hope is the mortgage goes down all by itself. On the law school value of education, in some ways, once you sort of capitalize that, what you want, and we'll go back to a timing schedule in a few minutes and the best way to go about it, but clearly from 1 year to the next, you'd like to see that $100,000 balance go down. Everybody got a pretty good grasp on that. So, again, the biggest exercise of that is to do it yearly, because that will tell you whether or not you've got your assets and liabilities correctly matched, and you should see growth that makes sense to you. To some extent, too, when you get down to the growth in this net worth number, it's the test about how you're spending your income. So let me just sort of venture out on a limb here. If you were to take your first year job and it pays $145,000, and you get a signing bonus of $25,000, let me tell you in advance, if you haven't worked a lot before, you may be disappointed when you actually get the net paycheck. Because that $145 and $125 sound really good, but it's amazing who gets a cut out of that. So you know right off the bat it's not going to show up on your financial statement. But you should create some personal expectations that if you've got that much cash flow, that it begins to show up either in a reduction of debt or an increase in assets. If you got to the end of the first year and you really did have a $25,000 bonus and $145,000 income, and there's been little or no reduction in debt and no new assets created, then you know you're back to the violation of the rule of you must be spending more than you make. And then you're the one who makes the judgment about, does it really meet your expectations? Are you seeing that reduction in debt and the growth in the assets at the level that you want? Let's just consider that one exercise and jump to another exercise. There were some questions about your credit history. And I've got actually a pretty decent parallel for you on your credit history. One is, again, sort of linking both your legal experience now and the financial world. On the legal side of things, particularly on the criminal, but I think it also is on the civil and some of the other organizational legal issues, you're always looking for in the legal principle whether or not there was an opportunity and a motive of some sort to try to explain or figure out intent or any of those issues. Your credit history literally is the same thing. In fact, I probably shouldn't link them like this. That almost makes your credit history the same thing as your criminal history. But in some ways, the analysis is the same. So when you're looking at somebody like me who might be a lender, I am looking at the credit history for more than its value as a piece of paper, just like a good judge should be looking at a criminal history to try to figure out what's in the mind of the bad guy or the alleged bad guy. On your credit history, it is going to show probably more than anything else your willingness to keep your promises and your willingness to repay. And most people seem to lose sight of that. You know, ads, commercials on TV sort of suggest that if you've got bad credit, we need to do something to fix it. You know, it's not your fault. The hell it's not. It doesn't make any sense. If you borrow money from me, all I want to do is rent it to you. So I want you to give me my principal back. If we're friends, I'm not a banker for this exercise. I'm your friend. If you ask me for money, I will loan it to you. All I ask is that you give it back to me when you said you'd give it back to me, and if I were going to charge you interest, that you pay me interest, which is the same thing as paying me rent. If your credit history reflects that you don't do that, you're not creditworthy.
So you can come in and say, I'm an attorney, I'm a UVA law school graduate, I make $145,000 a year, give me a loan. But if you've got a credit history that indicates that even if you have that capacity, you're not willing to honor your promises, you're not going to get a loan. Or if you do get a loan, I will charge you out the yin-yang for it. Your rate will go up. And that's what your credit history is really all about. There is a good resource, and because it's about 20 pages long, I didn't bother to print it because not everybody might want it. But if you just go on and Google MyFICO, M-Y-F-I-C-O, there's a really nice manual that you can get a look at for more information on your credit history. Fair Isaac puts it out, and it explains a little bit of everything about what's on a credit report, how the ratio is calculated, statistically who fits where, what it means to you in terms of reduced or increased rates, and what you can do if you have a problem, and even recommendations when you're about to make a major purchase and apply for a loan for how you can make sure you got the best score. The best scores get the best rates. And the best score is about 20% of the U.S. has. An okay score, the next 20% has. A pretty middling score, which almost means you're a subprime kind of borrower, about 20% has. And then 40% of the U.S. has a credit score that no prudent lender would ever lend them any money. And so that's what we're looking at on a credit history. When we're also looking at it, and looking at your own is kind of helpful, one of the questions was sort of how do you improve your score and what should you look for. What you will notice in this guide, but I'll just real briefly summarize for you, it's looking for all the credits that you have that are current and any that in recent times have been either paid out or closed. It's trying to evaluate from that about whether or not, number one, what's your willingness to repay. Are you somebody who actually borrows money and then always pays it as agreed? Not 10 days late, not 20 days late, not 6 months late, and not at all. I've had a lot of folks come in and go, what's the problem? I always pay my bill. But a whole bunch of 30-day lates will actually lower your score fairly directly because the lender is saying, I know you pay, but you don't keep your promise. You said you pay it on the 1st, and you don't pay it till the end of the month. And that's, you know, that will change your score, and that will increase your cost of borrowing. It also measures how many lines you have out there and whether it makes sense in proportion to your income. So I would discourage people, or my generalized advice would be, carry as many credit cards as you need, but no additional credit cards. Most of the rest of the loans will make sense because it'll show up it's a mortgage or it's a car loan, and you can readily tell from looking at a credit history what they bought with it. It's the unsecured lines that you can't. Occasionally, and maybe you've already seen it, somebody starts to pay for something in a restaurant and they pull out their wallet and there are 40 credit cards in there. I can almost promise you that person has a low score. Just because, even if they're not using the lines, Fair Isaac is smart enough to go, wow, this is somebody with $100,000 of credit available at the drop of a hat. And it doesn't look like they have enough income to support that. So even if they're behaving themselves, it makes us real nervous that they could spend that kind of money in a hurry. Also is historically looking at you for any radical changes in your behavior. So if you go out and you apply for credit at 20 different places, those applications will show up, and that will alert a prudent lender to go, whoops, what's going on here? Somebody is suddenly getting active in the credit market. That makes me a little nervous. If you suddenly went from a lot of inactive lines to active lines, it suddenly goes back to that rule. It looks like you're spending more money than you make because you're having to tap all your lines. And I say that because everybody, you have to rationally look at your own circumstances. I can think of reasons why people would do that, and a good lender might ask you about it and agree with your explanation, but too often you're actually going online or something to make an application and nobody has a chance to ask you and they're just seeing this behavior. You know, a lot of people just starting up a company, including perhaps a legal practice, might need to tap family and friends in every available line to get started. Well, it would make sense. That would suddenly alter your credit history because suddenly you went from a lot of inactive lines to maxing it out. Reality is maybe it was for a good reason, although there has to be a better way of doing it than that, but some people do it that way, and that's that would alter your scores. Yes?
So should you keep inactive lines kind of open? Because I've read things that say if you're not using a line of credit, don't close it because it lowers your available credit and makes your score.
It makes everything newer, and so in some ways you realize almost anything you do on your credit is going to change your score, and so you just plan ahead. You should not keep lines open that you have no intention of using, but there is some merit in what you say and what the explanation is. If you had for example, as a student, if you've had a credit card for a long time, but it's not that great a credit card because you got it when a student and it's got to go line, but it dates back to 1990, then that's your oldest credit. And if you close it, then your oldest credit just dropped off, and that's what alters your credit score. So if you've got one or two exceptions like that, it might be worth hanging on to, particularly if you're thinking you're going to tap the credit market sometime soon, like you're getting ready to buy a house. That's a temporary aberration, though. Once you close a line and about 6 or 12 months pass and the credit report settles a little bit, your score goes right back up. So conventional wisdom is, for example, if you are, and maybe the best example is, you're getting ready to buy a house, you want the best possible mortgage you can get, you want your score to be as high as you can get it, is to not do anything with your credit if you know it's pretty good until after you've applied for the mortgage. Once you've gotten the mortgage, you probably don't need credit again for maybe a couple of years, and then you ought to make the changes to get it cleaned up for the next round. And I, in all candor, the only people I see who've made a really big mistake are tapping the wrong types of credits for their purchases, and they've run up a long list. But clearly, the scoundrel in the mix is somebody who routinely borrows money and doesn't pay it back, or doesn't pay it back on time. And then the other one is just simply somebody just keeps adding on credit and adding on credit, and even if they're not using it, it suddenly gets a little scary because they've got too much out there that they could use. Other questions about credit? And it'll intertwine a little bit with some of the, when we get to buying a house and things like that. Yes, sir.
No, this is kind of an odd question, but I was just going to ask about, like, no credit, essentially. Because when I was living in New York, when my landlord did my credit check, I think it turned out that I just didn't really have any credit. I couldn't really use a credit card.
Yeah.
So
I've actually got some clients who do things, are so wealthy they don't ever use credit, but when they want to book a flight, rent a car, reserve a hotel for a long-term arrangement or something, they have trouble getting it because they have no credit. So, yeah, no credit is a problem. But it's not necessarily a big problem. Somebody just, especially if there's a good excuse for it. If you're a uniquely wealthy, well-established person, then you just get your banker to write you a letter of credit reference and you can ignore the whole problem. If you're just starting out, you actually have a little bit more of an issue, but you really have a lot more credit than you know. You just might have to volunteer it. Because all a lender really, or even a landlord, is going to do is pull your credit history and say, yep, no credit. Don't know anything about you, we're not going to rent to you, we're not going to sell to you, or whatever the problem is. And you just need to be proactive with them. The length of time that you've had a banking account with no overdrafts or no excessive overdrafts is good credit history. The amount of months that you've actually been paying identifiable rent is a good credit history. The fact that your name's on a utility bill and the utility bill gets paid on time is a good credit history. It just does not get incorporated in a pulled credit report, so you may have to volunteer to cover it. If you find yourself in circumstances where you don't need credit, you do want to establish credit. My recommendation, and I think everybody knows it, is that in this day and age, you can't buy anything over the internet with any efficiency at all unless you have a credit card. You can't make a hotel reservation and guarantee late arrivals. You can't rent a car. Even if you're not really using one, you kind of got to have one to flash it in order to get these transactions done. So I think you ought to have it. And the only other time I find that people are maybe not just paying attention and as a result get credit is sometimes females, and that with us A-type males or something, we put our name on the credit applications and don't put our spouses or significant others, and as a result we're both using the credit card but only my name is on it, might unfairly hurt my spouse. If you're in a situation like that, then I would make sure your credit is joint. Here's a catch-22. If I have a credit card in my name and my wife actively uses it, the first time she signs one of those little credit vouchers, and maybe you attorneys are the ones who set up this rule, but she actually is indebted for my whole line. But she's not joined on my account, so she almost gets none of the benefits other than the fact that she occasionally gets to use the credit card, but she's liable. Because that's what the little voucher says, is that that signing on this, you agree to all the terms and conditions of the credit account. If you're using a credit card and you're over the age of 18, you really ought to be joint on that credit account to make sure you have a credit history. I hit everybody's question on those. And as we go through some of these other ones, if credit, because especially credit history or how to establish good credit history becomes a credit or an issue or problem for somebody, I'll be glad to come back and give more clarification. I'd mentioned good credit is what you want, and if your credit fluctuates in that credit score because you're making good alterations, it only takes about 6 to 12 months to get it back to normal. So, for example, if you were applying for a home mortgage, and you had excessive number of credit cards, you really should get rid of some of those credit cards that you're not using in order to raise your score and get a better rate. If you do that, it could lower your score, so you want to do that 6 to 12 months in advance if you can. And just understand that that's how the process works. Fair Isaac's, the FICO's credit scoring system just does not do an instantaneous recovery. They want to see a longer-term trend, so you're not going to see an overnight improvement in your score. Bad news on one other front, and then I'll move off of your credit histories, is bad credit will haunt you for a long time. While you can improve it in just 6 to 12 months, if you have a really big problem, it will stay with you for 7 years before it drops off your credit history. So if you got a collection entered on your credit history because you skipped out on a telephone bill or you let a credit card lapse and you didn't pay it off and it stayed out there and it gets reported as an R9 or an in default credit, and it's a legitimate claim, it will stay on your credit history for 7 years. So good advice to everybody is guard your credit history from day one, because the bad news will stay out there for a long time. After 7 years, it does sort of die a natural death. Generally speaking, it just fades into oblivion and it's never out there again. So, and I did mention, you know, the two issues for you on your credit score is, number one, probably most important to you, is the availability of credit. So when you really want that house or that car and you really want the loan, you want to make sure your credit history gets the guy to say, or the lady to say, the lender to say yes. Second piece, though, is we now tier almost every credit on risk, and the lower your score, the higher your rate.
When you're talking about a goal for a credit score, what kind of credit score gets
If anybody's looking for themselves and you know you're entitled to look at your credit history anytime it was a factor in a loan decision and no charge to you, you also may look at any of your credit histories once a year through and it's not the lender, it's the credit agency like TransAmerica. You can get a free report for any reason once a year, and other than that, they might charge you $750. When you do that, or charge you a few dollars to get it, let me give you the scores and even the ranges so you can do it fast. Above 780 is considered perfect. If you had a reasonable amount of credit, always paid your bills as agreed, you'd have a score in the high 700s, and that's perfect. In fact, I'd describe that range as probably about 740. I don't think I've ever seen anybody that was over 800, so that probably is the max out. That would be about 40% of the borrowing population is in that category. A middling range, which will almost always get you qualified for a loan that you're not reaching too heavily for, is in the range of about 690 to about 730. If you get below 690, you're considered a subprime borrower, and you're going to be asked to get a cosigner, you're going to be asked to bring in some additional collateral, or you're just going to be told to go away. I think the next one is a little bit on some areas of unique interest to everybody, and that's how to manage debt once you have it, maybe particularly law school debt, but a lot of the other debt. And I have a couple of rules just to sort of throw out that I think will help guide you, and then I'll try to answer real specifically what you do with law school debt and perhaps some other pieces of debt as you get them. Number one is borrow only, as I mentioned, to finance an asset. Don't ever, if you can avoid it, borrow for any other purposes. I'd also get real clear for you on assets. I think, generally speaking, you would only borrow money to fund an education, buy a car, or buy a house. There's where you do not want to borrow money to buy clothes, go out to dinner. Generally speaking, you never want to borrow money if once you use the asset, it's gone, like a dinner, but there are a lot of other good examples. And you also generally don't want to borrow money that will reoccur every year. So generally speaking, you don't want to find yourself borrowing money to pay your taxes or to pay an insurance premium, because only 12 months from now, and you got to do it again. And if you did have to borrow money, you want to make sure it's structured so that you're out of that loan within a year. Otherwise, you just keep compounding it, and the total gets bigger and bigger. Always on your debt, including your student loans, and I'll get more specific on this piece in particular, is shop the rates and the offers. Do your best to make the lenders compete for you. The lending triads are not that far off. It is a bit of a commodity. And be sure to compare what is, as you probably already know, often discloses the APR, or the annualized percentage rate, not just the rate. So if I tell you I'll loan you money to buy a house, it's 6%, but then if you read the fine print, I got a whole bunch of add-ons. That may not be nearly as good a rate as somebody who says it's 6.5% APR, where it's all calculated in. You want somebody to disclose it to you in terms where you can compare apples to apples. By law, they have to, but sometimes you'll get confused if somebody says it's 6%, somebody else says 6.5%, you take the 6 and then go to closing and realize you got a whole lot of hidden fees in there. Yes, sir.
When you're shopping for rates, how can you, I guess, prevent the lenders from making multiple entities on your credit?
You probably can't, because as soon as you actually make an application, they will begin that process. You're given a permission to pull it, so they will pull it. That will create that, and I hate to describe it as a catch-22 because it's really not as bad as it sounds. Multiple inquiries will lower your credit score, but only very temporarily, and partly because anybody looking at it and the system itself knows that if you are, even when you're buying a car, you know, if you leave your driver's license while you go test drive a car, there's a pretty good chance they're pulling a credit history to see if they can pre-approve you for that loan to get you in that nice car. You'll end up with a bunch of loan, credit pulls where there is no activity to follow. Those drop off in a matter of a week or two. But if somebody were to check and they go, wow, I know she got about 10 inquiries, that's it. When you're renting, if you're shopping multiple apartment complexes and stuff, that frequently happens. That's a good question because that is something you can't avoid, but just be aware it doesn't hurt you for more than a real short-term window. And you will see a big difference in what people offer. Try to talk to a lender who knows the tax law a little bit, particularly when you get down to buying a house and looking at making home improvements and the like. Talking to a lender who actually knows how to best structure a loan so the interest is deductible may create a major opportunity for you. Or even looking at some of your other debts simultaneously and figuring out they can consolidate and lower your rates now that you've got a bigger acquisition coming. And then weigh it carefully to see if it really makes sense for you. More details on that in a second. When you get them to disclose all the terms of their proposal to you, make sure you're looking at the total cost. Make sure you're avoiding any prepayment penalties. On your debt management, another rule would be always pay down your expensive debt first. One of the questions was, you know, when I've got school loans, got credit card debts, got other debts, which ones do I hit first? It really is a matter of arbitrarily, or very objectively, not arbitrarily, objectively picking the ones with the highest rates and getting those out as quickly as possible. And I'll try to come back with some real specific examples of those for you. The only time you might want to preserve debt in your student debt can be a good example of that is anytime your expected return over the timetable that you have in mind is going to be higher than the interest rate on the loan, if you're comfortable with debt, leave it alone. Mortgage debt, again, is the best example I have. We're at 40-year lows or pretty close to it on mortgages, so as you get out in the market and are in a reasonable position to look for a home as opposed to a rental property, if you can borrow money at 6%, as a home purchase, you know, the first interest on the first $1 million is deductible and the interest on the first second $100,000, so total debt of $1.1 million, is deductible for any purpose. The first million only if it was used to buy, build, or construct, the interest expense on the $100,000 for any purpose, including buying a car, all that's deductible. So if you've got it at 6%, given whatever everybody's tax rates would be, maybe the after tax cost of borrowing that money is 4%. You've got some investments, your bonuses, your cash flow coming in. Should you curtail that or should you invest that money? If you're investing for a longer term and you expect a return that's greater than 6%, then leave that debt alone. Pay it on schedule, but don't prepay it. Is that clear to everybody? I hear that from a lot of older customers sort of going, you know, my dream was to be debt-free, but now I've got a balance out there and it's only at 5 3/4 or 6%. Should I pay it off or not? Some of the older faculty that's a common question for me, and it's a good question. If you would sleep better at night by being debt-free when you're close to retirement or retiring, for example, on that one, I would just pay it off. That sort of trumps every other argument. But if the other advantage is, I've got money in my TIAA CREF, I've got money in the stock market on the taxable side, it's been guaranteeing 8 or 10%, it's mostly in equities, and while it goes up and down, it's a long-term investment, and I expect it to yield 10%, I wouldn't get rid of something earning 10% to pay off something that costs 6% or after taxes 4%. I guess that's my case. I'm going to also come back on some of the structuring because something you're probably not eligible for in the next year or two or three, you will be eligible for it after that, and that is using any built-up in equity to probably reduce some of your debt and gain interest deductions that you might not otherwise be able to gain and lower your cost of borrowing. But most of you, unless you're a lot more affluent than I might imagine and already have a lot of equity built up, probably, you know, I won't spend much time on it in this context. Let's see if I've hit all the questions y'all had. So Somebody had asked if they should blend the rates, which is a really good question. You've got maybe undergraduate federal loans that are at really low rates. What I look at, they're 4% now. I think it's what people are locking in, 4.5%. Law school debt, probably not surprisingly, gets premium priced, and it's probably around 8%. And if you try to term it out over 10 to 25 years, it may jump to 8.5% to 9.75%, something like that. If this one's a lot bigger than that one, when it would make sense to probably refinance it all and try to get a combined rate. And the real answer to that is you absolutely just have to sit down and do the math. If you blended it, which one would give you the better return? I will give you a gut reaction is I probably would not. I mean, I would do the math and see if there's an overwhelming difference by combining it and see if there is a lender out there that might give me a combined rate at 7 or 6 or something and see if dollars-wise it comes out to be better. Then I would combine it. But my gut reaction is it probably does not. Just so if you don't want to get around to the exercise, I think the fair airing is to not consolidate the two. But clearly in a case like that is you want to accelerate the 8%. So anytime you have spare cash, you're probably not going to get a return anywhere that's a guaranteed return in that 8 to 9% range without a lot of risk. I would be working diligently to get rid of that expensive debt. So never prepay that 4 or 5% until you've gotten rid of the higher debt. Even now or later in life, the same issue applies. You got a car loan, you got a house loan, and whatever else, but you also have credit card debt. Which one do you pay down first? And the answer is whichever one costs you the most. Start knocking that one out real fast, and wait till later to pick up the others. Yes, ma'am.
So does that apply even if, like, let's say, like my undergrad loans are so much lower? Like, I mean, compared to $100,000 to $10,000, like it still applies to do that?
To leave it alone?
To leave that alone and work on the law school.
Yes. The rules can be a little bit different from package to package. If that even had a longer-term deferral, I'd even defer it and not pay. If you can keep the payments away for another 9 months or something, I would do that. If you're actually stuck making them now, I'd just keep up with minimum payments. Now, and you all might help me on this one. If you had a situation like that, and just use some easy numbers, you got $10,000 or $20,000 in undergraduate debt, $100,000 in law school debt, this is at 4%, and this is at 8%. Is that a pretty fair guess the way it is now? And if it is, if you were going to combine them, are you aware of a program that would actually give you a really good blended rate? Would it drop the 8% down to 5 or 6%? Okay. And an easy test just for your math, then, if that's the case, is just you can almost just look at the payments. And number one, caveats for all these things, assuming that all you're really going to do is continue making the payments until either it's a nominal amount left and then you might pay it off, but for the most part, for the foreseeable future, you're just going to make the payments, is take the blended rate package and just use the payments for the number of months that are involved, and then take the separate package for the number of months involved and see which one has a combined lower payment for the equal amount of time. That probably gets you home reasonably accurately and reasonably simply. And again, I mean, the only real fair answer to that is clearly the option you want to choose is one that's the cheapest, and the only way to get to that is to actually look at your specific circumstances and measure them out. You do want to preserve, though, the option to always prepay, and I'm presuming because this is often the case, is that you can prepay at any time and no extra penalties and no interest is prepaid. It's just simple interest accrual. If that's the case, that's a good set situation. And in the U.S., the rules are that's what most credits are supposed to be like. But I'd be the first to admit, especially on non-consumer loans, anything we can characterize a different way, if we're going to give you a longer-term fixed rate, we often have a penalty if you want to pay us off early. And there used to be sales finance loans for automobiles used to almost always be that way. There was no incentive to pay off a car loan early. You actually prepaid your interest up front and you just got screwed. That's not the case now. Most of them are simple interest. All righty. Yes, sir.
Also related to this moment, do you know some of these loans that have penalties to say if we're paying our loans back in the next $100,000 or 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 $100,000 or
In fact, you just alerted me to even a side issue on that I really want to point out. They should not have penalties. But the only way you'll know for sure is to just check your original loan agreement and see if a prepayment penalty is specified. If it's specified, you absolutely do. If it's not specified, you absolutely don't. Nobody can come in after the fact and tell you now there's a penalty. It had to be disclosed to you in the original language. However, that just reminded me of one thing I had glossed over too quickly. When you do a prepayment, be sure and direct the person receiving your payment to apply it to principal first and not accrued interest first. Because what you actually want to see is your principal on which all the future interest calculations are going on go down right away, and then you'll worry about paying the accrued interest. A lender's trick, and it's a fair trick, is if you don't tell me which one to do, I pay off all the accrued interest to date, which just makes me whole. It means I got my money faster. It's a good profit situation for me. And then whatever's left over, I apply to principal. But on most prepayments, they were not a regular payment that was supposed to catch you up on the interest portion of it. You really wanted it to go to principal. Home mortgages are the same thing if you accelerate those. When you make that extra payment, often if you're paying by coupon, there's even a little block that you check. Don't forget to check that. But anytime you're actually making especially a sizable prepayment, alert the lender that you want the prepayment to go to principal first, not to interest. It will save you a lot of money over time. If you're all ready, I'll switch to investments a little bit, where you put your money as you get strong cash flows. And it really is a hot one, because I am presuming that while everybody's got different job scenarios, a lot of you will be getting very attractive offers, and sometimes there are fairly significant cash bonuses. And suddenly, for the first time ever, but maybe for the first time in a long time, you're a lot flusher with cash than you've ever been before, and the question is what to do with it. First guiding principle is to always create your cash reserve before you go to long-term investments.
Again, for some of you, this will be elementary, and then it's a really good refresher for everybody, and especially up with the incident before. When you actually have short-term money, you can't do much with it but put it in a good money market or short-term bond. So if you've got money that you might need to get access to at the drop of the hat, or that you anticipate spending in the next year or two, it should go to cash or something like cash. Never put it in your checking account, don't earn any interest. And if you leave it in an interest-bearing account, a checking account, make sure you check the interest, because we bankers are probably paying you a whopping 20 basis points or something on your checking account, and that ain't the place to park your bonus or spare cash. You want a money market account. You don't want to pay any fees if you can help it, and you want something that looks like a six-month treasury bill return, which is incidentally today is about 5%, fluctuates between about 4.9 and 5.1. At the risk of being a little confusing for everybody, but just, you know, we're in an interesting environment today in that short-term money market rates are actually a little bit higher than long-term money market rates. We have an inverted interest rate yield curve that usually doesn't last very long. You usually get paid a lot for the risk of going long-term, so a 10-year treasury or a 10-year corporate bond would pay a lot more than a 1-year or a 3-year or a 5-year, not the case today. Best-paying corporate bonds and particularly treasury issues are at the 6-month interval, and it's about 5.1%. So short-term money, that's just a good quick tip. That's where to park it, is in a money market account paying that, or even just go to treasurydirect.gov, and buy it yourself directly online. No fees, no commissions. When it matures, it automatically goes in your checking account. If you haven't seen that before, it's www.treasurydirect.gov. And it is the way you set up your own account, and you can buy bonds for yourself, government bonds for yourself, or as gifts, or for dependents, or anybody else, directly. Don't have to go through a bank, don't have to go through an auction house. Debits your checking account or your money market account directly, and then puts it back in at maturity. That's real easy, keeps your records for you. Before, you always had to come to the bank, and I always wanted at least $50 for handling the transaction for you, so it's a good tip for a way to go in and out of the market on your own, on the bonds. I'm getting sidetracked myself. On your short-term money, then, you need about 6 months reserve. It was my recommendation. You take your first job, pays really well, but either you don't do very well at it or you hate it, and it doesn't last very long. You're going to want some sort of reserve till you get started again, and that will go with you all through your life. some point in the future, I'll come back to you when you've actually begun to accumulate some wealth and tell you, you really don't have to hold cash anymore if you don't want to. I'll put it all in long-term investments, get you a better return, and I'll give you a line of credit to be your cash reserve, because you probably are never going to need it, and therefore it'll never cost you anything, and it's there if you need it, and once you're wealthy enough, it's at very favorable rates. You can get away from the cash reserve. But I think it's safe to assume most of us for the first decade or so need a six-month cash reserve. That's priority number one for your investments. Before I get away from it, too, I would tell you that typically inflation, in fact, if you look for the last 50 years, inflation has averaged 3.1% or about 3%, if that echoes what you all have had in economics and other classes before. Cash for that same period, 50 years, has averaged with literally no risk, obviously. If you loan your money to the U.S. government or you put it in an FDIC-insured account, you expect to get it back. No risk, no real risk, and a 3.7% return compared to inflation growing at 3.1%. If you bought longer-term bonds, and those are both the short, immediate, intermediate, and long-term duration, for that same period, bonds have been yielding about 5%, 4.4%. So your next stage of investments is to have some level of a bond portfolio for cash that you don't expect to use for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, because obviously you can move it out. The reason I mentioned that inverted yield curve, it's an anomaly now. It's really simple. You could park it in money market accounts at 5%, or you could buy shorter intermediate term bonds, and you're all going to get about 5%. That said, then keep it totally liquid and keep it in the money market account. When the rates change a little bit, we'll stop paying a premium on it gets more to the bell curve, a shape that we're used to, and it will. Then cash will start paying a little bit less, and you'll get paid better for the rewards, and that's why you go to that second step. You all probably also know bonds have some risk in pricing, but given that you pick good quality companies, and the U.S. government, very little real financial risk, and then you can't get your money back. It's just if you want to sell it early, you might have to sell it at a discount. Cash, obviously, get back at full value. Stocks for the same period, and I'm using these as just the three broad asset classes that everybody talks about. Stocks for the same 50 years, they have pulled 75-year numbers on this, and they haven't changed, pay 10.4%. So if you had your druthers, obviously you want this. Everybody wants 10%. The reason you need a blend is both of these fluctuate in pricing, and so if you need your money at a certain time and it's fairly short in the future, you want it in cash. Money that you don't need for one, two, three, four years, you can put in bonds. Money that you don't need for 5 years and out, you can put in stocks. So here's a big tip, because it's the question of the day when you guys get it. When you sign up for your 401k or your 403b, which you will generally, if you're going to work for a good company, be eligible for at least in the first month. Not every company has them, not every practice has them, but most do, and probably the level you all admit, you probably do. You'll have that option. How would you invest your 401k or your 403b money? I would recommend 100% of it here. And if you choose either one of these, you're either thinking you're not going to work very long, or you're making a mistake. I will tell you, UVA professors make this mistake all the time. They go into their TIAA CREF, their deferred compensation for their retirement planning, and they go, gosh, I don't know much about that. I think I'll do 50-50. I'll put 50 in this part and 50 in this, 50 in TIAA CREF, which is the fixed income side, cash and bonds, 50% in CREF, of CREF being the equity side. The difference of that is if somebody came to work for UVA 30 years ago and is now getting close to retirement, if they've done the 50-50, they have roughly, a law school professor has roughly $1 million in that account. Good money. If he'd done 100% equity, he'd have $5 million in that account. Same level of contributions, just the way the market has performed for that time period. And the reason I say you should do that, the reason somebody would go 50-50 and they go, isn't that risky? And the answer is no. Because it's a long-term investment. You're not going to pull your money out of your 401k or 403b unless you make a mistake until you're 59 and a half years old. And if I'm guessing the ages in this class, you guys are nowhere near 59 and a half. It is a very long-term investment. And you don't have to take it out at 59 and a half. That's probably just the earliest that you'd be able to do it, because you're going to get a 10% penalty and other things, regardless of what it's invested in. Given that it's a long-term investment, there has not been a 10-year period in the stock market when there's been a loss. There have been lots of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 year periods when there's been a loss, but over longer periods, 10 years and greater, there have been no losses. And over 75 years, the average annual return is 10.4. And I would just tell you, just as a quick aside, just because it sometimes brings curiosity, if you look back over the last 50 years, the report I'm looking at is 57 years. In 57 years, the stock market has been up 44 years and been down 13 years. So you get to the end of the year, you've been up 44 out of 57, down 13 out of 57. Well, it makes everybody nervous because it does look a little bit like a roller coaster ride. At its best, it has averaged on those positive years, it's been up 20% on average. And on those down years, it's been negative by about 11%. Again, kind of scary, but if you were that 30-year professor, that means you got an average 13.32% return by being in there the whole 30 years, even if it looked like a little bit of a roller coaster ride as you looked at your annual statements. So again, that's a really common mistake I see, is everybody goes too conservative on a 401k or a 403b, but they're forgetting that it's a long-term investment. In contrast with your extra cash, when you go into a taxable account, you just open your account at a brokerage house, and I'll hit on some good recommendations here, even though they're contrary to what I do for a living. If you want to pay really low fees, have very low portfolio turnover, and you want to pay as few taxes as possible, even in your taxable account. But it would be on that taxable account where you might make withdrawals over the next couple of years, and you look for a more conservative blend in that account. We'll talk a little bit more about asset allocation. I mentioned when you're trying to pick your early accounts, and I can't offer something that looks like one size fits all. There may be folks in the room who have really large portfolio accounts, investment accounts, and this would not necessarily apply to those folks who can be a little bit more elaborate, take a little bit more risk, and play and have more fun playing. When you're starting out, you are very well just to take all the pain out of it. Look for index funds. Look for the cheapest index funds with the best track records. If you haven't had a chance to play with it before, I'd recommend 3, partly because they have great, great websites, great track records, and they're remarkably inexpensive. Probably Vanguard, number 1, T. Rowe Price out of Baltimore, number 2, Fidelity, number 3, but you can't go wrong with any one of them. They have very low managed fees. An index fund is probably 12 basis points. They do all the work, all the reporting, and that's all it costs you. And no transaction fees on top of that. A managed account that's really elaborate, 40, 50, 60 basis points. You go to a broker, who wants to sit down and talk to you about it, and if it's worth it to you, pay it, but they want an upfront load fee, probably 3.5%, 4.5% of your original investment, and then the expense ratio is 160, 170 basis points on average. When you're really talking about setting aside $5,000 or $10,000 at a time and trying to grow it, then an index fund makes perfect sense. I'd recommend some things to you, but it'll be your personal. You'll have a little fun doing the research on the different accounts that you might choose from. You're looking just for a diversified account. It could be the S&P 500. It could be the Total Market 2000, which sort of describes the number of large cap stocks it can be. Your amount grows, and you may actually segregate them out and pick a small cap fund, a mid cap fund, a large cap fund. Grows a little bit more, and you might go back to those 3 categories and put some in value and some in growth, or at that point it may get sophisticated and you may be so busy you call me up and want me to do it for you, and I'll be glad to. I would tell you statistically, another reason I feel real comfortable about telling you that the index funds work perfectly for you is that I'm not aware of any manager who beats the market consistently over a long period of time. So index funds track really nicely. Even the managers who do beat the market probably do not beat the market once you make an adjustment for taxes and fees. You're looking for good research on that. The founder of Vanguard, now retired, is John Bogle. He's got a lot of books out and was the father of the index funds. Has done a lot of really high quality university research to sort of back that up.
What type of, or what value of money should you start looking at kind of broker? What are you looking for?
No hard rule on that, because to a large extent, in my mind, it varies on how much time and expertise you personally have. If you have none and no appetite, in fact, if your eyes are already glazing over just from my presentation, then you probably want to hire somebody fairly quickly. If you kind of like it and enjoy the research, and I think a lot of you will like it, it's your money and it's more,
it's fun to be in control. I'd say you could have a significant amount of money. And partly because as you accumulate, when I go back to your balance sheet, while we can be here, you're going to find it's kind of naturally going to be in different buckets anyway. Probably one of your fastest growing accounts is going to be this 401k or 403d, and so you want to sign up for that and with the max. And that, literally, you're going to make some options on paper, and other than reviewing it once a year and just kind of mildly rebalancing as you see fit, you're probably going to be at least 5 or 10 years into it before you even really care to do anything differently, and you may be getting such high quality information out of that account you don't need to do anything else. Your taxable account, meaning the money that's not coming out of your paycheck and being tax deferred, that you're investing on your own, may be different, but that's almost by definition got to be a smaller amount, especially in the early years. And that, you know, I think you probably will, everybody will have a lot of fun doing it. That said, here is a better rule of thumb, is I don't think you should pay anybody more than 1% as a management fee. And I'd be the first to tell you, that's what we try to price everything out, is basically a 1% management fee. Above that, I think you're getting ripped off a bit. I just don't think what we do is that elaborate. And we certainly, you know, we will add a lot of value and we will show you a lot of discipline and we will help you with a lot of information. But above 1% is kind of too much. And to get to a real driving amount of money, then my group would say we can't work with you unless you pay us at least $10,000 a year. Is the kind of fee that we're looking for, and you all as attorneys will have some of the same rules. We'll charge you a set amount, but it can't be less than this because it wouldn't be worth our time if we didn't do it. So yours would be the same thing. So for mine, I generally wouldn't be willing to work with people until they were at about the $1 million level. You might find other folks that are willing to do it at smaller amounts, like $250 or something, but again, it's not a rocket science. It's a very healthy discipline, and it's a lot of good quality information, but it's not hard to master yourself. A couple of quick suggestions on that one. Easy research and easy in most markets, in fact the kind of markets most of you all would likely go to, is you might start at a good quality bank, and I don't mean to disparage community banks, but generally not a smaller bank, but somebody with a major training program and major products on the shelf and major access to the market. Even in Charlottesville, that would certainly be the SunTrust, the Bank of America, the Wachovia. If you had access to Citi or Wells Fargo, or you know, it's a pretty good list in that upper tier bank. Maybe easily said, any bank that's probably in the top 25% or top 25 or so in the U.S. are good names to go with. If you start in the private banking group, and the reason I'm telling you this is because it's free to sit down and talk with somebody and sort of show them your financial statements, show them your questions and your concerns. You may be able to get a really pretty decent plan with no bias and no cost to you. Second level of that is, this afternoon is probably a good example of that, is a lot of us just like to look at it and talk about it. As long as you're not asking us to do too much work, we'll do it for free. So that's your first shot. It's a free one. Second one is if the person says, yes, you got some pretty tough questions, this is pretty complicated, I'd recommend a full-blown written plan and all that, then they're going to quote a price, and that actually probably give you access to some pretty powerful folks that are really good and well-trained. Third choice is to go out in the market that you're in and just look for somebody who does it for a living. And the easy caveats there are almost immediately look for somebody who is a certified financial planner, almost as opposed to any other available designation. That should be somebody who does it for a fee only, no bias, not trying to sell you anything, but simply trying to give you expert advice. And I would guess in your early years, if I had to guess at a fee there, it's $1,000 or $1,500 is what you'd pay for that. Yeah, most of the banks, the experts that would help you would in fact carry that among other designations, and then there are a lot of financial, but Charlottesville would have probably 15 different financial planning shingles out there. CFP assures you that they have a decent level of education and skills, but only your personal interview would tell you if they really know what they're doing in comparison to what you're asking. And markets do vary. With bank mergers, for example, I had a reasonably big issue with alternative minimum tax personally, with stock options and the like that just came through the mergers. And when I turned to the local accountants, we don't have any Fortune 500 companies here. They hadn't seen AMT related to incentive stock options before. I couldn't find advice locally. Then Googling on the internet gives you pretty good access. Almost everybody has financial planning associations, and the College for Financial Planning will provide you names in your area of people that they would recommend to you. caveat of people to stay away from, and as this is being rebroadcast, I'll probably get in a lot of trouble for this, is anybody with a personal bias. You know, you might have a really good friend that you know well enough to know that from your academic background that you would trust to do this. That's perfectly fine. But if you turn to somebody who's just an insurance agent, or you'll find remarkably that whatever the plan entails, insurance is the solution. And it really is almost just a gimmick to sell you something whether you need it or not. If you don't mind, I'll give you a sort of an issue on that, but I see people fall prey to. When you're talking about insurance, which was sort of the risk management piece and the general advice, don't risk a lot, it's a gain a little, don't fall into buying insurance products that you don't need, because they generally will prove to be really expensive, really difficult to get out of, and in many cases there's not a reason for it. My favorite one would be on life insurance. If you are graduating from law school and you are single and you have no dependents, you don't need life insurance. Unless you want to make your parents or your aunt or uncle or somebody rich if, should something happen to you. One is the chances of something happening to you are pretty slim. Not impossible, but pretty slim. You all look like a pretty healthy crowd. But the other one is, who needs to benefit from your death? If you had a mortgage on your house, if you had an auto loan, geez, we'll just sell those things and pay them off. You'll die with a clean slate. You don't need to leave anybody with money. So you really are wasting your money to be sold something like that, I guess is my point. If you're only comfortable buying it, buy it. But I do see a lot of people right out of school, somebody calls on them and they buy it. I'm going, what would that benefit be for?
What if your parents are suicidal on your arms? Like, I wouldn't want to die.
That would be an exception. If you've got something that, should something happen to you that needs to be addressed, that's when you do it. And that actually is a good example, and I wouldn't really think in that direction. I was thinking more that most of you probably don't have a non-working spouse who can't take care of themselves should something happen to you. Most of you probably don't have children who obviously would need some money left behind to take care of them. So if you really are an independent person and you're not obligated to anybody else, you're being taken advantage of if somebody sells your life insurance policy. Likewise, generally speaking, focus when you're trying to transfer the risk of carrying expenses in your death to use looking only at term insurance and not whole life that has an investment piece to it. I do not offer as a one size all. If you have no discipline and aren't saving money on the side, then maybe having savings incorporated in your insurance premium really is a help to get you some discipline to build up an asset. That probably won't apply to most of you. Most of you are perfectly capable of saving some money and on a disciplined basis investing it directly. You will have lower expenses and a better return investing in real investments as opposed to within an insurance policy. If you make the decision and begin to buy, then you have a bit of a problem trying to get out of it, because most of those do have a prepayment penalty, or you forfeit everything you put in. So, and you know, that promised to go for an hour, and I do notice people have other commitments, so just to let you know, you will not hurt my feelings. If you've got to get somewhere else, just feel free to do it. And I'll try to wrap up in 10 minutes, but I also will stay and hold anybody's with any additional comments or questions people have, just to let you know. Okay, a trick, if you're looking for it. It's called the Rule of 72. I don't know that. A lot of times you're really curious that if I set aside a certain amount of money, how long would it take to double? And if you've noticed, good financial people sometimes keep popping up with the right answer, and you're like, geez, I didn't see your calculator. How'd you do that? Rule of 72 is a kind of a neat rule if you haven't seen it before. If you divide an interest rate into 72, the answer you get is the number of years it takes for that amount of money, that number to double. So if you're going to invest something at a 10% return, 10 into 72, 7.2, an amount invested today at 10% will double in 7.2 years or 7 years. If you got a 7% return, it'll double in 10 years. And so it's easy math when you're trying to figure out, is this investment worth, is something I want to look at. And most of the time, if you're trying to calculate your net worth in the future, you really are trying to get a blended rate on your investments at something in the 8% range, so you just know right off the bat whatever you're investing is doubling every 10 years, which is why I say if you start early and everything you put in this year, 10 years from now, 8 years from now, has doubled, and everything you put in next year has doubled in 8 years and stuff, that sort of compounding effect, and then each turn doubles again in 8 years, and that's just at an 8% return. If you're setting aside any real money in your retirement accounts and in your investment accounts, you will have a lot of money, which is another way of saying you don't have to take a lot of risk. You know, especially at your ages, you're not trying to catch up. You just, you know, steady wins the race. The worst mistake I've seen people take it is they get over-aggressive and want a 15 or 20% return and take a lot of risk, and all you have to do is lose on a couple investments to offset anything you could have possibly done otherwise. and as attorneys and the kinds of jobs you're going to be looking at, you don't need to do that. Righty. I'm buying a car. A couple of quick pieces of advice on that one. Buy what you got to buy. That would be the first one. So don't let me insult you by telling you you shouldn't get a Ferrari now that you're graduating from UVA Law School. But I would tell you, that, and this is from Warren Buffett, the sage of Omaha who created Berkshire Hathaway and is probably the most successful financial person in the history of the world, if there is one. And he owns a big stake in just about every company you can name. But Buffett drives a used car and always has. He calculated early in his career that if he bought a one-year-old car off the lot and he owned it on average 5 years versus buying a new car every 2 to 3 years, the difference in his net worth at the age of 50 would be $400,000. And he said, geez, I'd rather drive a one-year-old car. Not a bad car, not a clunker, just a nice car, but I'm not going to pay for it new, and I'm not going to trade it in every couple of years. And it'll be worth $500,000 to me in my working career, and that would make me happy. Now, if that won't make you happy, ignore that advice. You know, if you got to have the Ferrari, in some ways, you've earned it. On the other hand, it's a big mistake to keep buying new cars and trading them. And I think everybody in here realizes that you buy a car and drive it off the lot, it's worth a lot less, probably depreciated 20 or 30% the minute you left the parking lot. So if you can buy a car that's in really good condition, that's 1 year old, fleet cars and whatever else, it looks exactly the same. You can't call it new, but it's a whole lot cheaper to buy, and then you don't get that whack of the depreciation. Hidden expenses when you buy a really nice car are that most people don't think about. Taxes are much more significant. The risk of theft is much more significant. The risk of speeding tickets is much more significant. The cost of insurance is much more significant. And most really nice cars take premium gasoline, and when you go in and get an oil change and a tune-up, it's $400, not $49.95. So it is really expensive to drive really nice cars. Good advice for somebody who would really rather have money in the bank and big trips and early retirement and things like that is don't buy clunkers, don't buy dumb cars, but buy something that's a lot more practical for you. If you haven't seen it before, there's a really easy way to do that. There are a couple of websites, but my favorite is Edmunds.com, www.edmunds.com. On Edmunds.com, you can pick any cars you want, including those super expensive cars, and line them up side by side and look at everything you'd ever want to see about them, and in a really factual way that you're never quite sure you're getting if you went to the dealer to look at it. Incidentally, you can also go to each of the dealers' website, each of the manufacturers' websites, and get a lot of the same advantage, but you're generally only looking at what they made. If you go to Edmunds.com, for example, and you know about the size of car you want and what you're looking for, my other sort of fatherly advice, if there's any such thing, is I'd zero in on cars that are uniquely safe, that are uniquely reliable, that have reasonable capacity to take friends and luggage and everything else around, that have high resale values if you decide to get out of it. They actually hold their value over time. That they have very low maintenance costs. And I guess the list can go on and on. Edmunds.com tells you all of that. You know, just pick the next one. I recently bought a car just for a quick example, and I actually was sort of, my kids were talking me into saying, Dad, you've got to have something that's for you that you like. And so I liked a couple of the Audi versions. I liked a couple of the Volvos. There were a couple of ones that were more even more elaborate. And then when I started putting them out side by side, the stodginess in me came out, and I started looking at a Camry and an Accord and a couple of cars like that, and it was just amazing. If you put the pictures side by side, they look alike. If you put them side by side, the Accord and the Camry are a little bit bigger than the cars that cost $30,000 more. Their gas mileage is 25% better. Their maintenance costs are about 30% less. The interior space, headroom, shoulder room, leg room, hip room, is bigger. Their safety ratings are better. And I kept sitting there going, I do understand what my kids are trying to do. I need to change my image, but gee whiz. And you might do the same thing because, again, go back to Warren Buffett's suggestion to you is doing it that way may be worth $500,000 to you by the time you're 50 or 55 years old versus going in and out of cars every 2 or 3 years. That said, go back to my original caveat. If you got to have a Ferrari, get yourself a Ferrari. Questions on or concerns on buying a house. A couple of rules of thumb. If you're going to buy a house, I recommend it. It's an appreciating asset. It's a use asset. Not only it probably doesn't cost, especially after you've been in a year or two or three, you'll be surprised. It probably doesn't cost much more than the rent if you were staying in something comparable, renting rather than owning. The only problem is if you don't think you're going to be in a market for very long, a good rule of thumb is the break-even point occurs after the second year, and the math is actually easy. In most markets on a national basis, real estate generally tends to appreciate about 5% a year. Around here, there are a lot of markets that actually haven't appreciated 5% a year. Lynchburg is a good example to pick a close one. Waynesboro really hasn't. Charlottesville, Albemarle County have appreciated dramatically. But that's not a long-term deal. That's over the last decade. Real estate here has been kind of crazy. But if you went back over a longer period of time, it's only averaged about 5.1% a year. And that's close to the national average. Sleepy markets with very little turnover. Any of you come from a small hometown that may be the best place in the world to live. If it's a small hometown, there's a pretty good chance that houses cost about the same today they cost 10 years ago. Charlottesville, that's not the case. But no matter how you look at it, in any normal times, the real estate's appreciating at about 5% a year. Residential real estate, that is. If that's the case and it costs you 7% to sell it, then that's 12% you got to recover over the purchase price. You can't do that until it's appreciated for about 2 years. So if you're in a market, when you take your first job and you go, I really would like to buy a house, but I'm pretty sure I'm only going to be there 6 months or a year and a half, you're better off to rent. If you're going to be there more than 2 years, I would just jump on a house. A couple of things will save you a ton of money. If you can come up with a 20% down payment, you will save something called principal mortgage insurance that the lender is by law required to charge you. It does nothing for you. It just protects the loan. 20% down payment, PMI is not required. Better than 80% financing, it is required. On a $200,000, I have no idea what anybody would be looking at, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, whatever, probably is somewhere between $50 and $150 a month in money out the window to you. So a 20% down payment is real helpful. That said, it's worth it in the early going by only putting 5% down or something. It's the only way to do it. I'd throw that out. So the second tip is you can get out of PMI as soon as you have 20% equity. But the burden is on you to prove that you've got 20% equity. So if you buy a house and it does exactly what you wanted it to do, it appreciates fairly rapidly, the lender is never going to call you up and say, I noticed your house is worth a lot more than it used to be. Let's drop the PMI. You have to call them and ask them to drop it. They will require you get an appraisal. They'll actually order the appraisal. They just won't require that you pay for it, about $300. If the appraisal comes back in and shows that there's more than 20% equity, they will automatically stop charging you for the PMI. But you can tell at $50 a month, you can recover your $300, and maybe $150 a month, you can recover your $300 real fast. And it comes in, you get reimbursed from $300 because you now suddenly have to escrow less. Your cash comes right back to you. It's not stuck. It's a good tip. I think the other stuff I've sort of mentioned on that just is real clear. I think everybody, location is the real rule. Some of that, though, is predicting on which neighborhood is going to be the next one to come up. You all have been in Charlottesville long enough. I think you can ride around and know that some markets, some residential neighborhoods, everybody said that's a lousy location 3 years ago. It's not anymore. If you really got to know the community you're going to live in, you might have been able to pick that's an up-and-coming neighborhood and jump in. Also would encourage folks, if you're up for it, sweat equity is awfully good. That's a great way to reflect a great appreciation of a house. If you can buy one of the more inexpensive houses relative to the other ones on the street, even if it needs a lot of new work, and particularly if you're up to doing the work yourself, you'll see a great advantage over buying one that's been already fixed up. If it's already been fixed up, chances are you're going to pay full market value for it. You probably don't want to. Another piece that's really sort of not 100% accurate, but it's a good rule of thumb. You're driving through, you're new in a market. That was some of you were saying, looking back at Chicago or even Boston, if you were looking at townhouses and things like that. Is there an easy way to see if prices have been are fairly priced? In most markets, by law, they're assessed at fair market value, and in most markets, they're assessed annually. So what you can assume is that the tax assessment is pretty close to market value, but not this year's market value. It would be last year's market value or the year before. And what I have found from 30 years' experience as a lender looking at houses, I generally find that tax values run about 75% of what somebody would really list it for. And that might be a good test if you're looking for early, easy research to try to figure out what prices ought to go for in a certain neighborhood. other hints. When you're going most metropolitan areas, Charlottesville and Albemarle County are good examples of it. All their properties are listed online, so you can, you know, used to have to steal a multiple listing service book or beg the real estate agent to show you everything, and they wouldn't. Now you can go online and just look up the multiple listing service for that market. Charlottesville, for example, you would go to the Charlottesville Area Real Estate Association, CAAR, C-A-A-R, and you can look at every house on the market. It's got pictures, it's got specs, it's got price, it's got contact points and everything else. Beats the dickens out of driving around. You can probably do that in every market. Tax assessments are online, and so it's as easy as sitting here as you all are doing, and you can look up any property for background on it. Great way to buy a house. A great way to get the information you need to buy the house. How much income do you need? Most lenders will look at not wanting you to exceed 35% of your gross income to make your total house payments. If you've got other debt, they generally won't want the total debt. They'll give you a little bit more generous, but they generally won't want the total debt to be more than about 38% of your combined income. So if you've got a significant other who's buying the house, you obviously get the convenient kind of income. If you're doing it on your own, you don't. If you're taking in tenants and can prove it, you can often use the rent to offset some of the short flowing cash that you might otherwise have. So just a sort of side piece there. Yes?
I have a question that applies more to those of us going into public service who are not going to be
making that kind of money, yeah.
Bucks, but I would like to buy a house someday. When lenders don't want my total debt to be more than 38% of my income, do they take into account loan repayment assistance programs and other things that reduce how much I actually pay?
Yes, okay. That's exactly right. But that said, you probably have to point it out to them. They won't be smart enough to ask, and they won't know where to look unless you say. So there's a block typically on your application that says other income that you might want considered. And as you may or may not know, that often applies to things like alimony that you don't legally have to disclose unless you want to, but that's your opportunity to disclose it. So if you've got unusual sources and that is an unusual source, that's where you would want to do it. Lender then probably simply says, can you verify that or can I verify that? And if you can show them paperwork that shows you've got the supplemental things. Folks in public service, too, if you haven't seen it before, most states have a first-time lower-income home buying assistance program that often is very good. And with your educational backgrounds and the kinds of jobs in the public service side of the law, you're probably an ideal candidate. And there you may get 100% financing without PMI insurance. You might get a really low subsidized interest rate. And you can probably only take advantage of it once, and it would be the first house that you buy, not subsequent houses. So I would look for that. But as you might guess, I'm a real fan of buying your house as early as you can, as long as you are going to be in there long enough to make sure that you don't take a bath. Because your worst-case scenario is you buy in a market and you're only going to be there a year or two, and when you want to go, not only do you not get your money back, but nobody wants to buy it. And so how do you move to your next job in a great place, only you're now stuck with this house wherever it was you started out? So you want to be careful that you got the right cushions there.